This is Poetry Off the Shelf. I'm Helena de Groot. Today, the garden we share. A few years ago, Ross Gay got involved in the Bloomington Community Orchard. Together with a few neighbors, some of them experienced, some just excited to learn, they've been figuring out how to plant and weed and shear and harvest. And if you read his books, you'll find the garden all over, especially in his latest two, The Catalog of Unabashed Gratitude, where he explores the many complicated things he's grateful for, and The Book of Delights, with one essay a day for a year about something that delighted him. Both books hit a collective nerve. All of a sudden, Ross Gay was asked for readings and panels and interviews everywhere. So I wasn't worried when he was a few minutes late. I knew he came straight from another meeting.
I can't do something from 11:30 to 1:30 because I have a meeting. I call it a meeting because I always feel like shy saying I'm playing basketball with my student for an hour and a half.
I know. I wonder what that is. You know, everyone wants everyone to just be busy all the time.
Yep, exactly.
And do you still garden?
Oh, yeah. God. My partner and I are working in a community greenhouse, so we just pulled out all the summer crops. We had tomatoes and hot peppers and okra and cucumbers, and we just pulled those all out, and we just seeded all the more kind of fall and winter crops.
What are those?
We put in spinach, some mixed greens, some kales. What else? There was another kind of green that we put in there. The idea being that those will be, you know, fully grown by Thanksgiving or, you know, before that probably, because they'll stop growing once the light retreats a bit, but they'll just be there so you can kind of harvest them and they'll hold on through the winter.
Yes. So did you grow up at all gardening? Was that a family thing?
No, not really. You know, my mother's family was farmers. She grew up on a farm, and her grandparents, when they moved into town, they were pretty serious gardeners, and we would spend a little bit of time with them. A lot of summers we'd go there for a few weeks. You know, we were exposed to that. We grew up in apartments and we didn't garden in the apartments, but you know, there were like these woods, and in the wood or on the edge of the woods there would always be like raspberries and blackberries, and then there was a mulberry tree in the apartment at the edge of the apartments. So even though it wasn't the kind of gardening that I'm doing now, there was this sense of like getting out there and picking stuff.
Do you go on YouTube, or like where, how do you learn?
There's some of that, but I mean, like right now, like we have a friend named Mark who's a farmer, and he would supply us with spinach throughout the winter. So he knew exactly. He was like, you know, the third week of September is when you want to put in your spinach. So we were like, well, Mark said, you know, third week of spinach, you know. And then I saw him town, and he was remembering. He was like, oh yeah, I wanted to tell you, plant the seeds 4 inches apart in rows 6 inches apart, and then they'll fill out, and that's going to be how you want it, you know.
Yes, that's amazing.
It's beautiful. I mean, it's this sort of collective enterprise. We're all working on it together. We share the harvest, and we are sort of like figuring out, learning from each other how to do it. So it feels like this really beautiful experiment.
Yeah. So there's something about gardening that you do all this work and then you just have to wait a few months.
Yeah.
Are you a patient person?
I feel like, I think you're exactly right. Gardening, and you know, it's a little bit of patience to have something that you plant give you fruit or something to eat in 2 or 3 months. But, you know, I also plant trees, and I've worked with this community orchard project in town, and we just planted this nut grove. And, you know, by the time these trees will be in full production, all the people who planted them will be dead. And I love that. I love that so much. I love it.
Wow, that is such the poet's, you know, kind of thing to love.
Yeah, exactly.
When you see all the little shoots sort of come up, that's something that we all can pay attention to. But it takes this utter skill to also understand that things are happening when you can't see anything. right? Like in the winter when everything is covered and it's all underground.
Oh yeah, the rest is work too. Or the when we can't see what's going on, it's still going on. And that feels crucial, actually.
So has that happened in writing? When you go back to a poem that you haven't looked at in a while, has something happened while nothing was happening?
Oh my God, all the time. I mean, it's like 90% of the time in my writing experience is when I'm looking directly at the thing and I'm quote unquote working on the thing.
Uh-huh.
You know, things are happening. And when I look away from it, I'm able to hear what I'm trying to learn. The thing that I need to hear makes itself available to me when I stop looking so intently.
Mm-hmm. And do you have tricks to sort of make that into a system or something? Like, do you have ways of doing that?
Gosh, I don't know if I do. I definitely don't have systems for it.
Uh-huh.
And I think if I did, they'd quickly stop working.
Right. You want to not be systematic.
Yeah. I think that's right.
I was wondering if you could read a poem. It's that poem called Patience in the catalog of Unabashed Gratitude.
Yeah, I forgot, but that's what we're talking about right now. But here, I'll read the poem for you. It's called Patience. Call it sloth. Call it sleaze. Call it bummery if you please. I'll call it patience. I'll call it joy. This, my supine congress with the newly yawning grass and beetles chittering in their offices beneath me, as I, nearly drifting to dream, admire this so-called weed, which, if I guarded with teeth bared my garden of all alien breeds, if I was all knife and axe and made a life of hacking, would not have burst forth gorgeous and beckoning these sort of phallic spires, ringleted by these sort of vaginal blooms, which the new bees, being bees, heed. And yes, it is spring, if you can't tell from the words my mind makes of the world, and everything makes me mildly or more hungry. The worm turning in the leaf mold, the pear blooms howling forth their pungence like a choir of wet-dreamed boys hiking up their skirts. Even the neighbor cats shimmy through the grin in the fence. And the way this bee before me, after whispering in my ear, dips her head into those dainty lips, not exactly like one entering a chapel. And friends, as if that wasn't enough, blooms forth with her forehead dusted pink, like she has been licked and so blessed by the kind of God to whom this poem is prayer.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much there, but I'd like to start with that sentence. If I was all knife and axe and made a life of hacking, would not have burst gorgeous forth. Yeah, can you tell me about that?
I mean, the poem is, in some sense, it is like a little record of me hanging around and laying down in the grass in the garden. Mm-hmm. And had I not been just laying down, kind of snoozing in the sun, I wouldn't have noticed that the most beautiful thing in the universe happens and probably happens a zillion times at that time of year. And my lawn wasn't really well cut, quote unquote well cut, which is why the flowers were blooming. So it's a little bit of like, you know, thinking about maybe the violence of constantly sort of shearing one's life, maybe something like that. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Like if you're constantly sort of micromanaging your efficiency or something, nothing good's going to come from that.
Yeah, yeah.
And was that something that you were doing then?
It's probably something that I've wrestled with, or a thing that's sort of in me. Like, you know, I have another poem called The Puritan in Me, and this sort of...
Yes.
You know, the thing that you hear, like, be productive, do more, make the most, da 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 da, you know, like the, you know, hanging out and doing nothing, hanging out and buying nothing, hanging out and making nothing is perceived as aberrant behavior. You know, if you don't own a house and you kind of hang out and don't make anything or don't quote unquote produce something or don't buy something, it's basically illegal, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, and there's so many sort of layers to that, but in the quest towards something like delight or joy, that is definitely something that I want to sort of trouble, that need to be making something every second. I don't think that is a need that I want to cultivate. I'll put it like that.
Yeah. You know, but it, like, what are the ways, how do you bring yourself back to, like, how do you get rid of that feeling of guilt or that feeling of, oh, I ought to be busy, you know? How do you do that specifically?
Good question. I try to witness and acknowledge when I do feel that compulsion to be busy. When I say compulsion, I mean something that I feel compelled to do, not that I am inspired to say to do. I feel like I try to witness it, understand it, poke it. I mean, I think I have the ability to settle down in time sometimes, you know? I feel like you know, if I bump into someone at the store, I feel like I have the great capacity to hang out and talk for a while, which also makes me late to other stuff. So, you know, so it's like a thing. I can be fair present, enough. But then I can also be like, oh, shoot, now I gotta go. I live in a town where, like, I bump into my friends a lot. And, you know, I was just having a conversation the other day with a buddy in front of the co-op. And, like, you know, we talked for, like, 45 minutes, you know. I had somewhere to be. Yeah. I was, like, I needed to make dinner, you know, basically. But but it was just a lovely digression where we didn't produce anything. But we definitely became better friends.
I think there's, among writers, this sort of idea also of, well, if you wait for inspiration, you're not a real writer. You know, it's a job. You need to just show up, do the work, inspiration or no inspiration. So since you were just talking about the difference between inspiration and compulsion, do you have something where you go, I need to write so many hours a day?
I've tried to wake up at 5 o'clock. I mean, I probably did that for a year. Mm-hmm. Me and my buddy, like, we were sort of like doing this very seriously and, like, you know, and I probably wrote some stuff in the midst of that. I'm sure I did, but it was not like, it felt in some way punitive, like your work and punishment ought to be sort of connected to one another. It felt sort of like that. And I think about that a lot because I'm also, you know, I played sports. Like, I just was playing basketball earlier today. And the kid I'm playing with, he played serious basketball in college. I played football in college. And, like, the ways that you get trained to believe, so deeply believe that punishment is part of the way that you make anything worthwhile, that you stop understanding that you're punishing yourself, you know? So that the punishment actually just becomes some voice that you think is actually just in your, it's just part of you. But in fact, it's a kind of internalized self-hatred. And it's like, it's hard to sort of identify the ways that we are really, really doing that to ourselves, I feel like. And it's funny, you know, I am teaching this Intro to Creative Writing class, and I'm thinking a lot about teaching. And in teaching this, we're trying to teach it an entirely different way. Like, we're not doing grades. We're not doing all of the things that I've often experienced in terms of, like, well, when they don't do this, when they don't do this, when they don't do this, you knock points off. You knock points off.
Yeah.
You knock points off. And it's like, what if everyone just gets an A now you can get to work. You don't have to think about punishing people. Like, what then happens when we stop being sort of, what's the word? Compelled by punishment. That punishment is our motivation, as opposed to, like, interest or curiosity or love, you know?
Yeah. And what have you noticed that happens?
You know, it's like incredibly freeing for some people. It's also really hard to believe. I think it's just really hard to believe. And once that's like off the table, once we're like, we're not evaluating in that way. Like, we're just going to ask questions and try to make beautiful things together and try to like be together. People just make incredible things. You know, people make incredible things. And they also are with their classmates in the making of incredible things really beautifully, you know? So they're, I feel like we're able to sort of talk more beautifully and generously about each other's work when we're not actually doing it for a grade or doing it to be the best one in class or doing it to be, you know, the one who the teacher really thinks is brilliant. You know, if we're all just kind of like, well, let's just try this stuff out. You're all brilliant. Like, we know that. That's obvious. You know?
Yes. I feel like we just have to read this poem, Ode to the Puritan in Me, you know, encircling around it, basically.
yeah, let's do it. Ode to the Puritan in Me. There is a Puritan in me, the brim of whose hat is so sharp it could cut your tongue out. With a brow so furrowed, you could plant beets or turnips or something, of course, good for storing. He has not taken a nap since he was 2 years old because he detests sloth above all. He is maybe the only real person I've ever heard say sloth or detest in conversation. He reads poetry, the Puritan in me, with an X-Acto knife in his calloused hand, if not a stick of dynamite. And if the Puritan in me sees two cats making whoopee in the barn, I think not because they get in the way or scare the cows, but more precisely because he thinks it is worthless, the angles of animals fucking freely in the open air, he will blast them to smithereens. I should tell you, the Puritan in me always carries a shotgun. He wants to punish the world, I suppose, because he feels he needs punishing, for who knows how many unpunishable things. Like the times as a boy he'd sneak shirtless between the cows to haul his tongue across the salt lick, or how he'd study his dozing granny's instep like it was the map of his county, or the spring nights he'd sneak to the garden behind the sleeping house and strip naked while upon him lathered the small song of the ants rasping their tongues across the peony's sap, making of his body a flower-dappled tree, while above him the heavens wheeled and his tongue drowsed slack as a creek, on the banks of which, there he is, right now, the Puritan in me, tossing his shotgun into the cattails, taking off his boots, and washing his feet in that water.
As preparation for this conversation, I wanted to sort of, okay, be better about noticing things that delight me and that I'm grateful for and stuff, you know? So I was, every time I walked down the street, you know, I thought, okay, let's notice things. You know, I feel terrible for having to do this in preparation for an interview and not just in general.
That's
And so there was this little toddler. She was so happy with this puddle and she sort of revved up to jump. And then the glee when she discovered that she could just back out of the puddle and jump again, it was as if she had discovered the loophole in the universe. And she was really like sort of looking up at the sky and giggling, and it was so beautiful to see. And as I was watching this and I was making eye contact with the mom and both of us were thinking this is the cutest thing, you know, there was this strange thing that happened. I was hit with this, I don't know, I just got so weepy immediately. You know?
Oh, wow. Huh.
I don't know. It was sort of this really surprising shift. And I was just wondering, like, is that just me or is that a thing that happens?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, I think that's such an interesting observation. Because to me, like, part of joy is the glimpses of our, like, unalienation, you know, our being profound, understanding that we are connected, that, you know, in a most simple way, just profound momentary understanding or knowing of our connectedness, you know, and our, not just the, you know, the human world, but the deep connection. And that to me is also, if we're connected, we are also hurting, you know, we're also in sorrow. We're also, you know, we're dying. And it feels like important to me, or like beautiful to me, actually, that this emotion, the way that I think of it, is like a kind of way that we, I mean, I think of joy as being made of our sorrow, and also made probably something like of the understanding that we might hold each other's sorrows together, you know? Mm. And that, you know, that then makes me think, oh yeah, that response is completely, that just makes so much sense to me. That, I mean, that response makes sense regardless, but it's like, oh yeah, that seems like joy. Yeah. Half one are smiling and you're kind of crying at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah, that is so interesting. Indeed, you said that, you know, if you're connected, then you're also connected to hurt.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like so much of our acquisition, our buying of things, is in some way to guard against the possibility that we will have to, which we will have to, engage the suffering and the sorrow of other people, you know?
Yeah. There's this little poem you wrote about Eric Garner, the man who was choked to death by New York City police in 2014 and who said multiple times, "I can't breathe." The poem is called A Small Needful Fact, and it's not in any of your books. So I don't know if you have it somewhere where you can read it.
Yeah, there it is. A Small Needful Fact is that Eric Garner worked for some time for the Parks and Rec Horticultural Department, which means, perhaps, that with his very large hands, perhaps, in all likelihood, he put gently into the earth some plants which, most likely, some of them, in all likelihood, continue to grow, continue to do what such plants do, like house and feed small and necessary creatures, like being pleasant to touch and smell, like converting sunlight into food, like making it easier for us to breathe.
Yeah. So what is this? What is joy?
You know, I really feel like, and I go back to this metaphor of like in a healthy forest, there's like this, you know, the mycelium running between the trees that are communicating all of this information. And some of that information is like what nutrients need to be sort of shuttled around so that there's a distribution that will support as many trees as possible. You know, that there's this kind of conversation happening, and then the trees are the manifestation of that. But in some way I'm like, what if that sharing is the thing, you know? What if that sharing is the thing where we are like, we understand that we are together. And if you understand that you're together, like what might we do, you know? Like how might we live and how might we behave? I guess that's part of my question.
Yeah.
So joy to me, and that, you know, like I said, like it's not like, I don't think of joy as like a kind of a giddy emotion. I think of joy as being profound and, you know, weeping with a smile on your face, like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Just because I feel like I've been in thinking about joy, it has made me think that a joyless world is one in which we do not acknowledge or engage each other's pain, you know? That's a joyless world.
Wow. But that's such a, I mean, I've never heard this take on it, because every therapist and meditation teacher or something will tell you that, you know, having a gratitude journal is a good thing, but they never tell you that that's the way to connect better to other people's pain.
When I think of gratitude, like the more and more also thinking about this joy stuff, I'm thinking of like how lucky that we get rain sometimes, you know, how lucky that the leaves turn into soil, like how lucky that the bees pollinate stuff. And you think about what is happening to our pollinators. That is gratitude that is absolutely lit by sorrow, you know?
Yeah.
The second we actually put our shoulder next to someone else, like we're touching someone who's suffering, you know? You just scratch a little bit and you're like, what's going on in your life? And then you say again, no, what's really going on in your life? And it's like, oh yeah, that's right. That's right. That's what we do together.
I was wondering, like, yeah, you opened yourself up to so much more joy and so much more pleasure and so much more pain. And I wonder if you ever sort of bludgeon yourself with Netflix or something in order to just not feel as much.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I'll watch some stuff. I'll watch some stuff. 30 for 30, you know, like ESPN stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I'm interested in trying in community to, you know, feel my feelings and to, you know, be in the structures of care that I witness and have been held by and want to try to continue support, you know?
Ross Gay is the author of three books of poetry: Catalog of Unabashed Gratitude, which won the 2015 National Book Critics Circle Award, Bringing the Shovel Down, and Against Which, as well as an essay collection titled The Book of Delights. He also collaborated with a poet we had on the show a few months ago, Amy Nezuko Matatil. Together, they wrote the chapbook Lace and Pyrite, Letters from Two Gardens. Ross Gay teaches at Indiana University and gardens at the Bloomington Community Orchard and in his own yard. You can find out more on the Poetry Foundation website. The music in this episode is by Todd Sigafoos. I'm Helena de Groot, and this was Poetry Off the Shelf. Thank you for listening.